And we're back, Stripe Show Podcast, presented by Access Golf. I'm your host, Travis Fulton. Thank you for making us part of your day. I had him on the screen. Now I lost him. Where'd he go? Jason Birnbaum. He's joining us here today as he was on the screen. Now he's off. We're having a little technical difficulty. Might have to jump out and back in, but good to be back in the saddle here. As you, for those watching us on YouTube, thank you for joining us. You can see a little club fitting going on in the backdrop there. True Spec Golf, my club fitting partner here. A little driver fitting. I can see the mini driver in this guy's hand here. Driver fittings, fairway woods, irons, wedges, putter, you name it. We're doing it all here, and particularly lab putters, as you know. One of my presenting sponsors, absolutely crushing it. JJ Spahn switched to the lab putter, and he is he just won the U.S. Open. And I saw the guy, Joe Pavelsic, I think is his name, at there in Tahoe. He was using one of the lab putters as well. I think the one that Ricky Fowler uses. So they're just absolutely crushing it. If you haven't tried one, you should. And we're moving a lot of them out of here and getting a lot of results. This is going to be a fun one today. We got a guest that we had on about 3 years ago. For those that haven't seen it, go back into the archives and pull it up. 2022 had Chris Goddarep on when he was at the University of Oklahoma, and his coach, Jason Birnbaum. We did it together, and it was an awesome conversation of the journey that that Chris was on with Jason through his high school days into his college days, and of course since that, you know, he moves on and wins the British Open, or excuse me, wins the Scottish Open last week, his biggest win on the PGA Tour, which gets him into the Open Championship this week. So we've got his coach back on the horn here today to join us. Really looking forward to this discussion. Mr. Jason Birnbaum, first off, congratulations and welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me. I can't believe that was 3 years ago, to be honest.
I know, right? I saw 2022 and I couldn't believe it. I was like, wait, that was 2022. Incredible.
That's hard to believe.
You know, I went back and watched it again, and it was a cool conversation, you know, to see these guys back in their college days. I interviewed Ludwig Åberg when he was in college and the number one player. And I went back and watched that and just, you know, looking at him and listening to him back in the college days versus, you know, where he is now. And I did the same thing with Chris. And a lot has changed, you know, for both of these guys. As Chris gets his big win there, you know, I know this is his second win on the PGA Tour, his first being a Myrtle Beach, which was an opposite field event. And any win on the PGA Tour, obviously, is unbelievable. But this one, Jason, is different. I mean, this was an elevated event, the Scottish Open, leading into the Open Championship, going head-to-head with Rory McIlroy. That was big-time stuff. You had to be – were you nervous watching that as his coach down the stretch?
You know, not really. It was kind of a weird calmness to it. You know, he's just as prepared as he's ever been. You know, it's interesting. Like when he won at Myrtle last year, he really wasn't playing that well heading into that week. This event, it's in Scotland. I mean, he really has been sort of trending here for the last couple months, and his game has been showing signs, and the consistency has probably been there more than it ever has in a long, long time. So that you just had this sort of readiness to it. We exchanged a couple texts on Saturday night before the final round. And, you know, he already obviously knew about the Rory pairing at that point. And with Wyndham, I mean, that was a big thing. And you could just tell by the words he was using and his response that he was just ready to go. You know, no guarantee in playing well in that arena. But he certainly the preparation was there and the confidence was there and feeling good about his game was there. I got a ton of texts from people just asking questions about whether Chris can handle the, you know, the pressure of the pairing. And that was really never really an issue for me. I didn't think there was any way. I think that he wanted that pairing and was ready for it. Yeah. So there was a bit of a calmness there, you know, the bogey on one, you know, I think you never want to bogey the first hole, but you know, you just kind of felt like that settled him in anyway. It got some of the nerves out of the way early. There were a lot of holes coming up that were gettable for him. So, yeah, he just kind of rolled with it.
he outplayed Rory. I mean, head to head, you know, right there in the same pairing. I mean, it's one thing to beat a Rory or beat a Scotty, you know, these top players, you know, Xander, of course, where he was last year. It's one thing to beat him in a tournament down the stretch, but it's another thing to be in the same group and look him in the face and do it, you know, in the same group down the stretch. And Frank Nablo, I think, alluded to that on the telecast. He said, hey, you know, they're in the same group and Chris is outplaying Rory right now. So he didn't look phased at all. I mean, he looked like he was embracing it. The bogey didn't bother him. He came right back. He looked poised the whole week. There's a lot I want to get to, you know, with his game and technique, but I want to go to this right away because you were here in my studio here in Ponte Vedra, you know, for the players. And we had a little event here and some teachers and other people as we do every year. And, you know, the first part of the year for Chris wasn't the best. I mean, he had three missed cuts there in February, early March. He finished 16th at Puerto Rico. Then he missed the cut at the Players, missed the cut at Valspar. I mean, all things that happen to players on the PGA Tour, as we know, it's very competitive out there, and in particularly a young player. But I kind of got the feeling when you were here and we were talking, like, you know, something, it just wasn't quite all there yet, right? Like, it was, there were some good things, but it wasn't there yet. It hadn't clicked yet. When you go back to when you were here in the studio to where we are now and you look back, what do you think? Is there one thing or a few things that maybe clicked for Chris that started to get some momentum where he started rattling off some good golf, you know, early summer, and now we see him with the big win at the Genesis? What would you point to?
Yeah, a couple things. I mean, first and foremost, top of the list is the driver. I mean, driver is the most important club in the bag for him. It's his biggest weapon and best asset, and he hadn't been driving it well. He had shown some signs of driving it well. He drove it pretty good the first week of the year, Kapalua. But the consistency with the driver hadn't been there. The miss with the driver was a little bit too penal. But with that said, he was showing signs. He drove it pretty good at Torrey Pines on a tough driving course and played well that week. So I'd say the consistency with the driver was probably the biggest thing that was just missing a little bit. All the other parts of the game were pretty much there. But really right around that time, he really – things started to turn around a little bit with the driver.
Yeah, strokes gained off the tee, he's ninth. I mean, this is a guy that can move it. He's 124 miles an hour on average. I mean,
That's a little on the low end, but yeah, 124.
Yeah, that's what it says. Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, on PGAtour.com this morning, he's fifth, 124. So where would you put that? What's his cruising speed?
126, yeah. 127 is pretty much where he's sort of living. You know, the average is probably 125, 126.
I'm going to put a swing up here. This was pretty recent, right?
This was with him the week before Genesis. This is John Deere. Very recent, yeah.
You look at the swing and I go back to the conversation we had in 2022. You know, Chris has a lot of, you know, kind of fade bias components maybe that he kind of gravitates to. It's a swing that maybe is a little bit on the steeper side, and there's a lot of fade bias. And you kind of made comment at that time where you try to layer it in some draw components to maybe offset some of those things. When you look at this swing and when he's swinging the best, is that still the case?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you could see the training aid we've got on the ground there. That's really over the last couple of months been a big part of what we've done to get things a little bit more consistent. You know, because of his fade bias, you know, it gets him into trouble a little bit sometimes with the driver when those, you know, he starts hitting down on a little bit too much and the path starts getting going a little bit too much out to in. And the miss to the right gets a little bit more severe. You know, we've pretty much done a good job over the years of eliminating left for the most part. He's very rarely missing left, and you know, when he's in trouble, it's just a little bit too big of a right miss, and that's sort of what had plagued him earlier this year quite a bit. But as you can see, we've got things a little bit more square. Really, the areas with the setup that get him off are he starts aiming too far to the left, and the ball position starts to get a little bit too far forward. And those are you know, big ones in terms of getting those path numbers getting a little bit too severe. So we've sort of squared him up a little bit more, moved the ball position to him, what feels back a little bit. It's really pretty amazing when you make the adjustments, like when we're on the range and we've got some, if you know, if we're using TrackMan, I mean, the numbers will change quite a bit. Like when I first got to the U.S. Open earlier this year, I think it was Monday at the Open, you know, he was just a little bit too much with the, with those numbers, right? He's probably six across, and then we get him squared up and we get the ball position back a bit and he's down to two. So when, when he gets those numbers dialed in like that is pretty, the consistency really changes quite a bit. And these are,
so the ball,
I mean, these, yeah, these, Travis, these are things that we've really worked on since he was a kid.
Right.
Which is pretty interesting. But, you know, I mean, we see that with everyone, right? I mean, it's always, you know, the best players don't have 10 things wrong, right? They've got certain things wrong, and then they're always, you know, sort of slipping back into some old tendencies. I think the really, from my perspective, the really helpful thing for Chris, I haven't even really talked to him too much about this, is that when he does go off, most of his issues are setup related. We've talked about it quite a bit, but it's just much easier when your issues are setup related and not so much swing related. I mean, this kid's got the golf swing, right? He's had this golf swing since he walked in the door to see me when he was young. I mean, we haven't made too many changes to his golf swing, but his swing improves when his setup is better. The numbers improve when his setup is better. And when you can get a high level player dialed in through setup, it's a lot easier than when you've got to make, you know, real positions and angles changes.
And I want to go, you sent me some video when he was younger, and I want to go back to that here at some point here in the podcast. But what's interesting are the changes that you talked about with the driver, the ball position feeling a little more back and the body lines feeling, I would anticipate the shoulders in particular feeling a little more closed to the right. Like, yeah, those are two things that I would say most amateurs need to feel more of, because
for sure
with the driver, the tendency with that forward ball position is they turn their chest and they face it, right? They look like they're almost like trying to turn and look at the ball. And then of course that gets them aiming way left.
For sure, yeah. And it was interesting to hear Nobolo, sorry to cut you off, but Frank on the telecast, you know, a lot of these, you know, top commentators were really seeing Chris kind of for the first time, right? Because the event that he won was opposite field. And, you know, hearing, you know, someone that knows a lot about the golf swing like Frank Nobolo talk about some of the characteristics of Chris's swing was really cool. But he made mention of his grip quite often, about how he has a strong left hand and a weak right hand. And that weak right hand, getting his right where he gets his right hand too much on top of the club is another one of those things that sometimes gets his shoulders opening up too much. And his right hand being on top is a big part of his swing. So we've not wanted to change that in an effort to square up his shoulders, but, you know, sort of all those things together, when you get the aim too far left, the ball position too far forward, the right hand too much on top, which opens the shoulders, it's like too many of those things together, you know, cause those numbers to get a little bit too severe. So getting the shoulders more squared up through the ball position and through the alignment and you know, the way his feet are on the ground, it has really done a good job in what you said, squaring up his shoulders, despite his grip, his right hand grip being a little weak.
When he's cruising, is he, so his path with the driver is a little, maybe 2 degrees to the left. What's his attack angle?
2 to 3, and his attack angle 0 to 1 down.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's one of the misperceptions oftentimes with amateurs when they come in here. Excuse me. They're like, well, I got to hit up with my driver to get more distance. And that's true. But PGA Tour average on, I think right now is what, -1? Maybe it's closer, maybe slightly closer to zero. To -1, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
And so you think about that, the best players in the world, right? Trying to maximize distance and accuracy, 0 to -1 down. Now, can you be 2 down? Yeah, you can. I mean, 4 degrees down, 5 degrees down. I go back to when Tiger was really struggling with his driver. He was like 7-8 degrees down at one point. I mean, it was crazy, you know, when he kind of got into that, those bad habits that he had with the driver. But more times than not, you know, an amateur comes in here and they're over the top and they're steep and all right, they're 4 or 5 down and, you know, getting their grip a little bit better, getting them more squared up, getting the path a little more front side. Okay, starts to neutralize that path. But I think oftentimes are like, well, I got to get this to like +4, +5. Like, you know, let's pop the brakes a little bit on that. I mean, that's when we start, you know, getting a little too far the other way. And so there's a happy medium there, I think, when it comes to the attack angle for everyone. And for PGA Tour, it's right around zero to slightly down on average. Now there's guys that are a little bit up and there's guys that are more down. But it's just always an interesting conversation, I think, and one to understand when you're looking at a player, not just a high end player like Chris, but an amateur player that comes in. I want to real quick here with you, and you look at him here, he almost looks like at a dress, you know, his chest and his head's looking a little more to the right. Is there any trigger there or a cue for him that helps him with that?
Moving the head to the right is a big one. You know, as you can see with his leg work, he tends to get a little bit reversey and has a hard time, you know, sort of getting behind it and loading. Mm. And that head move off the ball is a big, big part of what helps him load up behind the ball, despite, you know, that little bit of reverse in his legs. We got away from that a little bit in the last year as the driver started to struggle. We took a trip out to see Greg Rose at TPI earlier in the year, and that was good to see some of the data and what his, you know, sort of what his head and chest were doing in relation to the ball. But a big thing that we sort of took from that was that head movement sort of triggering, getting the backswing a little bit more. You know, we're always trying to get it more rounded, less steep, and a little bit more behind it, less reversey. And that sort of start with the head sort of moving to the right a little bit as the trigger is a big, big part of all those things.
Yeah, you can see it. I mean, you can see the head kind of, you know, starting the way. Because you did mention his leg action, and this is something that Chris has had from, it seems like, from very early age. Here's a college video that you sent me back in his Oklahoma days. It almost seems like his legs are a little more passive there than they were in this video, where it looks like he's turning that right hip and getting a little more travel in that left knee. You know, maybe he's trying to go at it a little bit harder here on that particular one. But his leg action has been dynamic, and it's early, right? Like he gets his legs turning. He gets that gap and that window opened up between the knees early. And that's something he's done from a very early age, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I've always thought he's got a little bit of sort of old school Jack in there too, a little bit. I mean, just the way the head moves a little bit and the way the leg work is. And there's these, you know, kind of similar build to old school Jack. And that's not probably a bad thing to be anything like old school.
No, not at all. Yeah, it's – I'm going to go to I want to introduce this one. This one's fascinating. I mean,
here's an old one. This is probably maybe around 17, just maybe starting Rutgers time. quite a bit different. So back in those days, you know, it was a very different setup. It was sort of a handle high, sort of super upright setup position. There was a lot of sort of arms club away from body in the takeaway. That one actually is not even that bad, but he used to sort of get his arms and club head much, much more out. And then there would be a lot of sort of runoff up there at the top of the swing. The arms would really sort of get lifty and it had a big uprightness to it. And, you know, it'd get away with sort of 6 through 9 iron, but really struggle with the longer clubs with that swing back then. It was, you know, it was very, very one dimensional with the left to right ball flight. Yeah, that definitely a little bit more inconsistent with that swing, but that's always a fun one to go back to and look at. It's interesting. I forget who it was on the coverage. It might have been Nobilo, but they made reference to comparing Chris's swing to Craig Parry's swing. I mean, very, very different people. But there is some in my early days working for Mitchell Spearman, Mitchell was working with Craig. I've spent many, many hours with Craig. So it was kind of interesting to hear one of those guys.
That is interesting.
Craig, because they were just comparing it to Craig's ball flight. I mean, Craig hits sort of a pretty big fade. That's about where the similarities ended, though.
Well, and also, you know, when you look at this, you know, and I go back to the conversation we had in 2022, you alluded to between this time and then as he turned professional through his college days, he lost about 40 pounds, right?
I mean, yeah, he ended up losing 40. About it a lot. I mean, that was a really, really big, big part of this whole thing. I'd say probably between sophomore and junior year at Rutgers, he lost 40, 50 pounds. And that really changed things from a swing standpoint. He was not always having the easiest time getting things more, you know, around his body, stretching his left arm a little bit more, you know, a little deeper in the backswing and getting it a little bit more across him. When he lost that weight, those things, you know, it wasn't really even by design, but that just the consistency of that and allowing him to make that swing change, that was actually really big in those years.
Yeah, you can see here he is now.
Yeah, so, you know, you see
that left arm more around, yeah.
Yeah, he's just totally different, yeah. Yeah, so it's interesting. Like, he couldn't draw back then. He absolutely could not hit a draw to save his life. I mean, there's no way, especially with a longer club. But now, with the way that his arm structure is going back and the setup adjustments, I mean, that shot he hit into, what was the par three there? We hit it to 2 feet, 15, I think it was, 15, where he hit that five iron. Yeah. I mean, that was back left in and looked like a little draw swing. And, I mean, he has the ability to shape it that way now, for sure.
Yeah. Kind of fun here. You look at this, a little split screen here. This is, again, back his going into Rutgers, so he's 17. You know, the club, you look at the left arm more upright, club shaft pointing a little more left.
Yeah.
Still
little... And that on the range, with, you know, that's him pretty square on the range, a little bit easier on the mat with seeing those lines. But on the course, he would make that swing with a setup that was much more left and open, which would exaggerate that ball flight even more.
And now here he is. You can see the left arm definitely deeper, more around. You know, I think what's fascinating to me with this journey and where I give you a lot of credit is, you know, he's got the fade bias components in his swing and he loses the weight. And so now he can get a little bit deeper, right? He's always kind of had that leg action, which opens the gate for the left arm to certainly get a little bit more around him, and losing the weight's going to help him do that. He's not as big and the left arm not as trapped. And so you square him up and now he's got more depth and all of a sudden he can hit a more right to left shot. But you do that and you work around the left hand grip, right? You don't touch the left hand grip. You don't touch the extension maybe that he has, that little steeper nature in the shaft coming down, which, you know, Jason, I mean, all you gotta do is turn on Instagram and you can see the craze of flexing the lead wrist, laying the shaft down in the right form. I mean, it's easy to get caught up in that, right? I mean, it's easy as a teacher. Sure. Like, we know the benefits of that. But when you have a high-end player like this, you made the decision, hey, that's the grip, that's the wrist angle, and we're going to do things around that, right, for him to be able to hit the types of shots that he's going to need to be able to hit at the next level. Is that an accurate assessment?
Absolutely, and don't take it that I'm not trying to get him to change his ball flight or become a drawer of the ball. I want Chris to hit a fade, and
right.
We've actually had times over the last year or two where things have gone off, and we've sat down and be like, listen, we got to get back to, you know, the consistent fade. But we're just trying to eliminate the big right miss, right, and just getting it less steep, not necessarily way shallow. You know, wedges are a big part of his game, as you know, because of his distance. He's going to have wedge in his hand a lot, and you know, to hit some of those low flighted wedges and get to some of those back left pins, you know, he can't really have lots of that sort of high floaty cut spin on it. And Chris likes to hit low penetrating draw wedges, 1 yard draw, 2 yard draw. So that has allowed him to do that a little bit more easily. You know, the configuration of his clubs, he tends to have his clubs a little bit on the flat side, lie angle wise, but the wedges are more upright to be able to get the ball to turn over the other way. So that's been big. But, yeah, the stuff you mentioned, I mean, Jason Gust is a great teacher in Chicago. He's a good friend of mine. He asked me to send him some swings the other day so that he could show his students that are trying to get rid of that cup that maybe that's not the best thing to do because that's all you see on the internet. But it's a good point you brought up.
Were you – okay, so on that point, you go back to when he was 14. Let me ask you this first. Let me set it up this way. When you – because you started with him when he was 14, right?
Yep.
Okay, so how good of a player when you first met him, like – where was he at then, and what kind of kid was he at the age of 14?
Yeah, he was just super raw. I mean, you know, when he walked in the door that day, I mean, you know, he, the distance was there. I mean, for a young kid, he bombed it. He just hit, you know, it had he hit very high ball, high driver, lots of spin, and it was a bit of a slice in ball flight. So, you know, he was hitting a lot of great shots, but he was also hitting shots off the map often. But, you know, it was just like I mentioned, it was just sort of a one-dimensional, big sort of down and across kind of slash at it swing. You know, raw talent, didn't know too much about the swing in those days, as most 14-year-olds don't. But, you know, good athlete, lacrosse player, you know, good hand-eye coordination, you know, quiet kid, but you could tell that his mind was working and that he was smart. But yeah, just a lot of raw talent, a lot of speed and power and good natural ability.
Did you ever at any point consider, hey, let's think about that grip going this way and that left hand going this way? Did you ever consider it at any point? Were you like, nope, that's off limits?
Never one time.
Yeah. Nope. Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because like, I'm not the only teacher, but we, you know, we're in this business and we know how wrist angles work with the wrist or with the grip combination, and Jason, you know, kind of going down that path with some of his students too, right? And saying, hey, not every player has to be, you know, Dustin Johnson,
right.
Jordan Spieth. Like not that's one way to hit it.
Yeah.
And
it was interesting because Chris is always, he hits it solid. Like,
yeah.
it's just a different sound, right? So
yeah.
You've heard really sort of expert people in this game talk about it. Like Chris did a Scott Verplank podcast earlier, maybe a year ago or so. And I mean, Scott is, you know, was at the peak of golf, right? And he knows what ball striking is and what it sounds like. And I remember him mentioning in that podcast that the first time he saw Chris and heard him hit a shot, he had never heard really that sound before. I mean, just the strike and, you know, the pop off the face. I mean, that was a sound that was, you know, sort of he had never heard before. So for someone like Scott Verplank to make that comment is obviously pretty impressive. So, you know, Chris was always, he was always so solid. So, you know, the average golfer that has their left wrist cupped and the face open and, you know, they're not delivering it the right way, they're not hitting the golf ball solid.
Right.
So, you know, that was the reason why I would never change that, because he knew how to deliver the club to the ball and strike it.
Yeah.
So
that, there was
that,
no need.
Maybe if it wasn't like that, you know, maybe if he had a weak ball flight and didn't hit it like yeah. that, then I would address it. But, you know, I just think it's like pre-TrackMan days or pre-any technology days when we were really in early in my career, at least when we were only going by the video, you know, you made changes often for aesthetic purposes. I mean, mm-hmm. That's just what you did, right? If something looked mm-hmm. really off, you changed it, unless it was a phenom and they just made it work.
Yeah.
But with the technology that we have now, it's like if certain things are under control and lined up and, you know, the numbers are good and impact is good and ball flight's good. And it's like, what's the point? What's the point really in changing those things? What are we
right.
really going to get out of that?
Yeah. I mean, there's look, if no matter the grip type of grip wrist combination, I mean, if you're able to take the club face and bring it down and lean the shaft forward and get the face on the ball in the center of the face time and time
yeah.
again, I mean, like that
Even,
is that is the object here. That is the object of the game in the end. And then
right.
because if you have someone that can do that, right, if someone, no matter what their age is, then you can do other things around that to, you know, kind of – influence the attack angle in the path, right? Like you talked about with the driver, if those are the pitfalls that they fall into, and TrackMan can help us with that, or a launch monitor can help us, you know, understand that. I mean, even with that said, I mean, you can just look at the ball, right? I mean, you can look
sure.
at the golf ball, and the golf ball's telling the player, and the player can tell the teacher that, hey, this is an issue, and you can make those decisions based off of what the ball's saying. If you need the data to help, that's fine too. But
yeah, Smiley Kaufman, he mentioned it too in his pod. He had Chambly on recently on his podcast. He talked about a story that where he was paired with Chris in Puerto Rico a couple of years ago, and you know he just couldn't believe how the strike that Chris had on the ball, and he was you mm-hmm. know he couldn't do, he said I can't do what he's doing. So, yeah. You know, when you have a talent like that, it's like, you're not going to change anything for aesthetic purposes.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's fascinating. Like for a teacher, I mean, it really is like when to go to the grip wrist angle combination and when not to, and you got to take the level of play, into consideration. You have to take the skill set, obviously, into consideration. You have to take the student and who they are and how much time they have to practice into consideration. There's a lot to consider when you start doing those things. And when you get a player like a Chris Goddard up who knows how to get the face on the ball and lean the shaft forward and compress the ball, you know, that kind of genius kind of, you know, in the hands kind of thing, you know, where you know when you see it, and you know when you hear it. You got to be really careful, right? I mean, you got to be really careful. I can remember like back years when I was working with, you know, when I was doing a little bit of dabbling in the professional ranks, and I was working with Fred Funk for years. And Fred's like, not long, but one of the straightest drivers ever. And he's always had that left hand's always been a little weak to neutral, and then the left wrist pretty flat at the top, not flex, but you know, not certainly not this way. And he, one time we were hitting balls, and he looked at it and he goes, I think that left wrist is too flexed. I'm like, what? And he's like, I think I'm going to go ahead and try to put a little cup in that top. And I was like, whoa. Like, let's pump the brakes here just a little bit. Like, you've played golf your entire life with this grip wrist combination. I am not letting you, for whatever reason, that right at this point in time on the range at TPC, to think that you've got to be a little bit more there, because you think you're a little bit more there aesthetically, right? He was just looking at aesthetically, which I didn't show him a lot of video. And at that time, as soon as I did, I knew, I was like, I think I made a mistake here.
Right.
But to that point, he was a little bit the other way, like Dustin Johnson, you know, weak, bowed, you know, that's on the other side of the world. Mickelson, you know, his right hand at the top cupped, right? And it was cupped coming down. Where that shaft would get a little tippy, and then from there he would have to manage it. The thing that impresses me the most when I look at this, and I want to ask you this question about with his swing, and I'm going to go back to this driver swing here, is, you know, usually when you see the shaft get like a little bit on the steeper side, like you'll see the player kind of, you know, almost kind of stand it up a little bit, let the club kind of exit a little more down the line, like a VJ, like a Phil. But Chris, I mean, you watch this club, like he gets it to exit under that left shoulder. Like it, yeah. I mean, it turns the corner, like right there. See that? Like it turns the corner quick.
Yeah. Yeah. He's always had that ability to get that thing, yeah. That grip exiting sort of left. And yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And like, you know, usually like when they're a little bit on that little steeper side, like their tendencies to be here. But like when I look at all of Chris's swings, I mean, it's just like it gets here and it's just like whoa, around the corner. I mean, not only is it solid, but then it's around the corner in a hurry.
Yeah, we for sure, 100%. I mean, it's a big part of it. We, you know, we definitely probably earlier, you know, sort of late last year and early this year, when he was not driving it well, that was probably not as good. That was a big part of what we did this offseason, and trying to get back and started looking at a lot of old college videos with the driver when he drove it so well. And there was definitely a period of time probably from sort of last October through this February where the driver had gotten off, and we worked toward getting back to that spot with the driver.
Mm-hmm. I was looking at his, stats here. God, since the player, I mean, since that time, I mean, players Valspar, I mean, his driver, strokes gained off the tee, positive 2.4, 1.1, 5.1, 1.6, 3.6, 4.5, 2.6, 4.1. And I'm going to assume at the Scottish Open, where I don't have the stats, I'm going to assume that he was at least strokes gained off the tee positive 4. I mean, he started getting dominant with the driver.
Yeah, and his strokes gained in general have improved. I think he's like 32nd in the world strokes gained total over the last whatever, maybe since February, so it's really been all areas. It's definitely drivers, definitely number one, but it's definitely been all areas. He's hit the irons better. He's wedged it better for sure. You know, he's had weeks with a putter that it's been really, really solid. He putted great at Scottish. I mean, he really, really putted good. Those, you know, the speed control was excellent. And, he really made a lot of those sort of 4, 5, 6 footers that he had to. He talked about it a little bit in his press conference. He added a degree of loft on the putter this week, which was big, over there on those greens. And, you know, Chris's tendency with the putter in general is just to leave it a little bit short and not get it to the hole. And he mentioned after the second round, after he tied that course record there with 61, that he just felt those greens, because they're probably a little bit slower than the U.S., you know, just forces him to be a little more aggressive on the greens, get a little firmer. And he definitely got it to the hole and passed the hole more often last week when he won.
Yeah. Speaking of putting, a quick break from one of our sponsors. If you're like most golfers, you blame yourself when you miss a short putt. So after you hold back the urge to throw your putter in the lake, don't do that. You try to fix your putting stroke. But how long does that last? 1 week, one round, one hole? There's a company called Lab Golf that doesn't think you should be blaming yourself. That's because all putters have this thing called torque, which means the putter face is trying to twist during stroke. So you grip it like a snake. What Lab Golf did is they figure out how to make putters with no torque. They call it lie angle balance. And you have to feel it to believe it. I did. The Lab Golf putter, you don't have to use a funny putting grip to try to keep the face square. You can putt it any way you want because Lab Golf putter stays perfectly square by itself. It's effortless. To see how much easier putting can be, head over to labgolf.com. So when a player adds loft or takes away loft, like what's the purpose there? Like when a player does that, because, you know, that's something that happens quite a bit week in and week out.
You talk about with the putter?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it just has something a little bit more to do with green speeds. Putting's certainly not my expertise, and Chris has got some good putting instruction going right now. But I think in general, I think the extra when there's not enough loft and you're kind of bank sticking it into the ground a little bit, and it, mm-hmm. there's definitely a little bit of a bounce in the beginning, and I think that sort of definitely is a little bit less when the greens are a touch slower on the over there. That was just a big thing we talked about when we were at John Deere. And we're starting to think ahead to playing a little bit in Europe and Scottish, and then hopefully getting into British. And, you know, that was something a lot of the guys were talking about, was adding a little bit of loft to the putter.
Who's he work with from a putting standpoint, Jason?
He just started with Tim Yelverton, probably. Okay. I think he started with Tim at the U.S. Open. Tim's great. They've had some really good solid sessions, and obviously it's paying off a little bit.
Yeah. There's some, looks like some momentum since June.
For sure.
He's starting to show up in the positive strokes gain, which, hey man, if you can drive it like that and your irons, you can strike it positive 2.5 with your irons, make a few putts, you're going to be a factor. And I tell you, and I want to transition to this here with Chris, is because you brought it up. A lot of the guys with media were texting me about, can he handle the group? And I always kind of got the feeling with Chris that I don't know him like you do, obviously, but from the time that we had him on the podcast in 2022 and just watching his demeanor, like, and just looking at his track record, I mean, this guy's won. I mean, he's won at every level. And yeah. I mean, he won the Met Amateur. He won the New Jersey Open. I mean, he was, you know, before he went to Oklahoma, guys, he played at Rutgers. He was a Big Ten player of the year there. Then he went to Oklahoma. He was a Big 12 player of the year. I mean, you know, this guy's been in big moments leading up to that and has performed at a high level. So I just, you know, got the win at Myrtle for his first win, opposite field event. And then now he puts himself in this situation, his biggest stage yet, and outplays Rory. I wasn't surprised. Has he always had that mentality where, you know, I'm confident to win, or is that something you guys have talked about and he's improved upon since, say, you started with him at 14?
He's really always had that. He really has. I mean, he's got two, you know, tangibles that are hard to teach. He's got power and distance, and he's got fearlessness. And I mean, those are things that are impossible to teach. And he's naturally gifted with both of those things. And I mean, when that's the case, I just feel like the sky can be the limit. And he's really always had those. I wouldn't say he's cocky. He's just confident. And, you know, he knows what he can do and he knows his ability. And, you know, he's done it. The win at Myrtle was big. Yeah, it was opposite field, but it's not easy to win. And he also won by six.
Right.
You know, he won by six, which I think was I think Scotty won an event by five last year. I don't think anyone won an event by six shots. So, you know, that was big. I mean, but no, he's always been like that. I mean, I've told the story before. I took Chris out with me when he was really young. He was probably at Rutgers, and I was coaching a guy playing in the Travelers, and I was coaching Roberto Diaz, and he was playing a practice round at Travelers with Joaquin Niemann and Abraham Answer, and I invited Chris to come out with us, and he walked around and spent the day inside the ropes, and, you know, he was a kid, and, you know, it's intimidating being inside the ropes as a kid, and I mean, Joaquin Niemann was, mm-hmm. you know, whatever, 19 years old and a world-class player, and Abraham's done what he's done, and so I have had kids in that environment before, and, you know, they can't talk. They're so nervous. And you could just tell by the way Chris was walking around that day. I mean, he felt like he belonged there. And, mm-hmm. you know, Chris is a little on the shy side and doesn't say a whole lot. But when we left that day, I mean, he you know, he said to me, I can play with these guys. I know I can be out here. But it's much more in a confident way than a cocky way. And he's sort of always been like that.
Yeah, it's a quiet confidence. He reminds me of, and I'll go back to baseball here in my Northwest roots, but, you know, Cal Raleigh won the home run derby last night, which makes us all really proud. He kind of reminds me of Cal, man. I don't know how big you are into baseball, but Cal is having like this historic season in baseball right now for a catcher. He's leading the major leagues in home runs. And I think they're pretty close in age. Cal might be a touch older, but man, I'd love to see those two meet because there's a lot of similarities there, man. Like they're, you know, bigger dudes. They've had success leading up to it. This quiet confidence, power game. I don't know, man. There's like a lot of similarities there in their style, and sure. age. So I don't know. There's a little parallel there with Cal winning the home run derby last night in the season that he's had. I this word that you said is sticking in my mind, fearlessness. Man, you know, it's when applied appropriately, right? It is a really strong asset to have. And I don't think just in golf, but I think just in, you know, in probably everyday life and kind of trying to pursue your dreams and accomplish what your skill set and your mind and your body and everything is capable of accomplishing, that fearlessness. Can you teach it? I guess you could probably, you know, move the needle, right? And to some degree. But for those that have it, you know, and they're kind of, it's just kind of in them, like it's, they're going to take maybe a little risk. There's no fear there. They just kind of go for it. That quiet confidence, man, it goes a long ways. And just listening to you talk and going back and listening to Goddard, this dude has it in spades.
He does for sure. And again, he's always, it's sort of never been really talked about, but it's just always been there. And anyone who's been around him or has hung around him for any, you know, period of time would sense that. And it's great. It's been really helpful in helping him get to where he needs. There's been so many things along the way that have been, I mean, so many good influential people and his whole college experience, going to two different schools, the Rutgers thing, you know, sort of being hardened by playing in New Jersey in cold weather. And, you know, Chris didn't move away when he was younger to Florida because he wanted to play golf year round. I mean, he just sort of, you know, he toughed it out, right? And then, you know, he goes to Oklahoma and he learns how to play in really windy conditions and firm conditions and great competition and two really good college coaches that he was around and good programs with lots of structure. You know, it's been a long journey and it's been positive really the whole way. And it's really interesting. I mean, even the little, you know, the little bit of hiccup that we've had swing wise late last year and early this year and struggling a little bit with the swing and being really for the first time in our, you know, sort of run at this whole thing, it was probably the first time that he really struggled with ball striking. His short game got unbelievable in that time. I mean, the guy's chipping and putting, you saw it on display at Scottish. I mean, he couldn't do that. Like Chris was last year when Chris was the best college player in the country at Oklahoma, I don't think his short game was great. I mean, he hit it really, really good tee to green. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he didn't putt very well, and his chipping was probably the worst part of his game. But that stretch of golf where he didn't hit it great, I mean, the short game got really good, and that's not going anywhere anytime soon. He's got that now. So, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, was probably a blessing in disguise in him being able to, you know, sort of hone that part of his game. And, yeah, things have been good. He's got a good team around him, too. I've been doing this for a long time, and, you know, having the right people around you, his parents are great, his siblings are great, his agent is great. He's just got such a good nucleus around him. And, you know, being on the young side like he is, I just think that's so important. And I've seen guys go down bad paths with things like that, but he's got it together, and it's really, really cool to watch.
All right. Two questions and I'll get you out of here. So you go back to early in the year, a lot of missed cuts. You now currently look at the last 5 or 6 weeks, obviously trending and playing at the highest level that he has played at the professional level. Chris Goddard managing some, you know, troubled times. You alluded to he lost his swing, kind of some failure in professional golf versus Chris Goddard winning the Scottish Open, you know, and playing great golf. Same dude. How does he handle success versus failure? Have you learned anything about Chris through that journey?
Yeah, I mean, it just comes back to his personality. I mean, he doesn't, you know, he's got it going. I mean, he doesn't get too high with the highs. He doesn't get too low with the lows. I mean, you saw how he reacted after he won the Scottish. I mean, he's not, you know, he was not surprised to win that golf tournament. I mean, you know, he was obviously ecstatic, and, you know, it was a culmination of a lot of things, but I mean, Chris is a calm, cool customer. I mean, he just knows what he's doing, and he's confident in what he can do, and he just sort of goes out there and does it. He's not, you know, biting his nails and, you know, looking like he's out of place and pacing up and down when there's a weight on the tee. I mean, you know, he's strolling down the fairway with having a conversation with Rory like it's, you know, a practice round. So that demeanor has really served him well when he struggled, and I think it will serve him really well when he's at the top of the game. Like he is right now.
Last one. Chris Goddard continues to have success on the PGA Tour Win Tournament, which we know how hard it is to win, but continues to put himself in that environment of winning. Chance to win if he does what?
Drives it well. Drives and putts it well. I mean, he just got to do what he's – I mean, when you're hitting a 360 in the fairway, you don't have to make everything. I mean – You just got. I said to him, and I said to his dad, really, I think he could be the best driver in the world. I said a couple years ago. There's just, you know, you see how important the strokes gain stat is, right? I mean, there are rounds where Chris is not hitting that many fairways, but because of his distance, he's still like 10th or 20th in strokes gained, even when he's a little off. So with his distance, if he's hitting it in the fairway or near the fairway, if he's hitting in the fairway or the first cut of rough, I mean, he's just going to be hard to beat. I mean, it's just that simple for me. And I think he can be, I think he's proven with what he's done here the last couple of weeks, I think he can be the best driver of the golf ball in golf. And I think that will really put him in contention a lot more often than not.
Good stuff, man. Hey, Jason Birnbaum, go check him out. Golf, he's a golf top 100 teacher. Instagram at Jason Birnbaum Golf. And then he's got a website, jasonbirnbaumgolf.com. That's jasonbirnbaumgolf.com. Right. Manhattan Woods up in the Northeast. Hey, man, I've known you a long time, and I'm happy for you, buddy. You deserve the success. I know you've worked hard with Chris, and that was really awesome to see him win, but I was happy for you as well. So thanks for joining us on the Stripe Show podcast, round two from 2022. This time we won't wait quite as long to have you back. Or maybe Chris will come back on as well, because my favorite thing in re-listening that whole thing is when you made the comment, you go, this is probably the most technical we've ever talked in our entire life together.
I was like, we got into X's and O's that day. That's right.
I was like, oh no. I said, Chris, if you play like crap next week, it's my fault. I take consideration. I apologize. But that was a lot of fun.
Didn't faze him in the least. Thanks for having me on, Travis. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Jason.
Bye.